This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you ka-ching. Ka-ching. Come on, guys, we talked about this. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. And once you start selling, Shopify makes getting paid simple by instantly accepting every type of payment. What I love about Shopify is how, no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level. You want to grow big? Shopify. You want to grow small? Shopify. You want to grow medium rare? Also Shopify. Shopify powers 10% of all commerce in the United States, and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy.
This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th, and it's making me feel joy and sadness and anger, definitely some disgust,
Rose,
and I think a little fear. But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel-everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, rated PG. Parental guidance suggested. Only in theaters June 14. Get tickets now.
You're listening to iFanboy Talksplode with Kieran Gillen.
Hop a swan on the dance floor. And my goals have turned to fast.
Hey, welcome to another edition of iFanboy Talksplode. I'm Ron Richards, filling in for Josh Flanagan this month, and I wanted to take my Talksplode time as an opportunity to catch up with writer Kieran Gillen, who longtime iFanboy listeners know we're all a big fan of here at iFanboy. Recently, it was announced that Kieran was taking over the main Star Wars book from Jason Aaron, as well as continuing on with his creator-owned book that he does with Jamie McKelvey, The Wicked and the Divine. It's been a while since I've talked to Kieran, so I had a nice conversation to catch up, hear about his plans for Star Wars, how he approaches it, hear about what it's like to be on a successful creator-owned book, and we started things off talking about his hobbies. So, Kieran, to start things off, I wanted to ask not so much about comics, but, you know, I know you've got a reputation for, you know, your relationship with music and things like that, as well as, you know, you spent some time as a computer games journalist, right? But I wanted to ask you about one specific thing I've noticed on your Instagram quite recently, a lot of miniature gaming. What can you tell me about these little figures that it looks like you're playing with all the time?
It's funny. So I get, obviously, like, I sort of semi-joke about this in terms of if I was a completely cynical monster, which of course I am. It's like, you know, the books I do, everyone assumes I'm like hipster scum, which is fine because I pretty much am. So the idea of spending all my time posting pictures of miniatures is this kind of a passive-aggressive note of, you know, I'm no way cool. You need to understand this. I started basically like as a kid, you know, like my background is like music and games and whatever. But I must have been like 11, so 86 when I started, when I first got into like Warhammer stuff. About, you know, I certainly could afford them then. And I kind of had a relapse, like one in 2001, and then another relapse in 2008 when I was doing some work for Boom. I was working on this Crown of Destruction, this like 4-issue mini thing. And my then girlfriend, now wife, bought me a box of Skaven as a present for like a birthday. Skaven being an army of like sentient rat creatures. And I actually did that as a joke.
Let's just think about what you just said out loud, by the way.
Yeah, it's okay. I'm an adult who says the word sentient rat. In fact, I'm presently looking at about 300 sentient rat creatures on the shelf ahead of me, which is quite the visage. Quite, you know, it's this panorama of nonsense. I really do love Skaven. As a kid, they're like the army I always liked, but I could never afford to buy them because they're a horde army. And, you know, there's no, you know, a horde army means you have shitloads of the fucking things. So anyway, my wife bought me as a joke and I took it as permission. So I started like just on the quiet, like, you know, kind of going like 6 months without paying any, then paying some more. And if that ambled along for like years until like maybe 2012, maybe slightly later, when I suddenly looked at them, I had about 200 of them painted. And I thought I should probably play a game with these things at some point. And that was what I wrote my friend Matt Sherritt, who's like, you know, basically a writer is the best way to describe it. He kind of works in governmental stuff. And I wrote him to playing with me, and then he got into it, and it's sort of amped up quietly since then. And it's, how to phrase it? It is a meditative and quiet thing I do with my hands. It's like, I can't imagine it's what I do instead of knitting. Like, I quite often do it when I'm watching television, or, like, you know, stuff that I don't really need to watch closely. It is, how to phrase this? It is something that I will get no money for. There's no risk of me ever painting miniatures and turning it into cash. And the problem with me, I've somehow managed to turn my entire life and things I love into money-making things, which is good because, you know, it means I love what I do. But it's bad because it means everything I do is work, like literally everything. So the idea of actually being able to turn off and just do this thing, which is both constructive, as in here are some things I've done and I get better at it and I can see them on the shelf, but simultaneously doesn't mean anything.
Well, that's good. I mean, you need to have something that kind of rewards and gives back. But
Oh, yeah, 100%. It's incredibly, like, it's one of the few things I know. I tell you this, it's the only thing I do which stops me looking at the internet. You know, so it's very much me in self-care mode. So for self-care, I mainly paint rat armies with skulls covering them.
Well, I've been impressed purely on Instagram just at the sheer volume and frequency of photos of these miniatures, as well as other various games and things like this. And the thing is, I know you're in the general London area. The space is at a premium. I got to imagine. I believe at one photo I think I saw there was a large crate full of gaming paraphernalia. And I was like, man, where is he storing all this stuff? It's
just I'll have to send you a photo of my current workplace. Which might be useful, but literally I've got this edifice of, like, the books in front of me are basically just cover these little fuckers.
Good. I mean, it's good to have a little personal therapy kind of thing, especially if it gets you off the internet, that's for sure. Something disconnected.
It's quite, you know, it's genuinely quite fun. You throw the stuff when you're playing it. It's hard for us. Warhammer as a game isn't much of a game. As in, it's really about the spectacle and the colour and the storytelling and the fundamental silliness of it all. So it's like, I quite regularly just drag people say, oh, I want to play a game and see what it's like. You know, we set up the table, we have a little war, everyone goes there. I did one with Jamie recently and Katie, who's like Jamie's girlfriend, and, you know, she works on support stuff on WICDIF. And that was fun, you know.
I was going to ask about the storytelling aspect of it, and how does that, you know, being a storyteller in your own right, does that fuel, like, have the games progressively gotten better as your storytelling has gotten better? Or
tell you what, when I end up going back to more physical games, which isn't, you know, the painting isn't just the kind of gaming part, because, like, for me, like, for like about 5 years, I was painting the Skaven before actually deciding I should probably play a game with them. my kind of amount of tabletop in terms of, like, real world gaming has increased, whilst my kind of, like, video gaming has dropped off sharply. In fact, the first video, I played like 4 hours of a AAA game at the weekend, and that's the first heavy real world, you know, AAA video game I've played for like 4 or 5 years. Like, I've really kind of stopped it. At least part of it is because my time is so brutal now. In that the idea of me kind of sitting down and playing a video game by myself means that I don't see my wife for hours, or I don't see my... So the great joy of a tabletop game is I can get together with my friends. So I tickle the social itch, which is something I get. I tickle the gaming itch. And, you know, I quite often also tickle the drinking itch at the same time. So it's kind of, in my weird level of efficiency, getting together and doing a tabletop game is an efficient use of my time that kind of keeps me in some degree balanced. And, you know, and I love the form. But to answer your actual question, I ran a campaign around 2011, 2012, but I ran like this 30, we ended up going for like 30 sessions or something. And the thing that struck me as not having seriously run an RPG since like my late 90s, how much better I was in terms of, I don't necessarily mean that egotistically, I mean that in kind of how much of the skill set of being a pulp writer is transferable in terms of, like, you know, really basic stuff like knowing when to end the session, knowing when to have to cut around drama, knowing how to plan in a way which is fruitful and useful, you know, and even like stuff like dialogue, you know, I can improvise my, you know, Kieran Gillen style bullshit dialogue all day. That's kind of, this transfers over. We did that WICDIF issue, the interview one with the journalists. My God, you've got me in a talking mode. I'm sorry.
No, it's good. No, please. That's why I've contacted you.
It's like we did that one with the journalists, and the way that was done was basically we got on a Slack, and I, you know, chat role played with the journalists. So I was improvising like Baal and Lucifer and Morrigan dialogue live.
Oh, cool.
You know. And that kind of like that absolutely comes from the experience of like being role play stuff, and it's just interesting how everything sort of feeds into each other.
Right. Well, it's funny because I would say that the two main things that you're working on right now, in terms of, you know, your creator on project with Jamie and The Wicked and Divine, and then the whole Star Wars universe, both of those I can see direct, you know, through lines to role playing games. You know what I mean? Like, hell, you know, I played Star Wars role playing games as a kid. We've all played. I mean, we played them with the action figures and, you know, in our backyards, right? But it seems as if both of those are uniquely well suited for that style of storytelling or adventuring.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's the sort of I think yes, the idea. I mean, the interesting about role playing game as a form, it's is big. You know, in terms of you know. That was my kind of, as a games journalist, my thing was always kind of dig to the weird margins. So kind of in RPGs, I do that a bit now anyway. But also I like hitting the kind of the big mainstream kind of Star Wars kind of beats. And the idea of like seeing the expansive stuff there is certainly interesting. Yeah, I mean, there was a kind of a free rolling pulpish narrative device. You know, I remember like one of my friends when I was running the campaign. It was basically a Warhammer campaign, but it was kind of inspired by Naomi Klein's Disaster Capitalism. So the idea of... I'm not even joking. The idea is, in the Warhammer world, traditionally, chaos is the great, you know, it's the great antagonist to civilization. And the way I played it is that, you know, I was treating chaos like purely as a natural disaster. And then every time something which was based around chaos happened, humans just made it worse. And that happened. That was all the way through the campaign, every single step of the way. Chaos did something bad, and humans, by taking advantage or not, generally made a terrible situation. And that was me trying to basically do a kind of political game about the present, you know, the period world politics in the Warhammer world. You know, and probably, that sounds like the sort of fucking book I write, you know, as in here's a pulpy sheet, here's a pulp book with a bit low of wank inserted into it. That's the Kieran Gillen flavor.
Well, there it is. So moving from Warhammer to another kind of war with Star Wars, first off, congratulations on the announcement that you're taking over the main book.
Thank you very much.
I gotta admit, I was surprised by that, and I want to hear about how that came about, because like my at least as the bystander, you know, kind of watching on the sidelines, you know, Marvel gets the Star Wars rights, you do Darth Vader, Jason Aaron does Star Wars, and there's been a couple years of that, and then you wrapped up Darth Vader and continued on with Dr. Aphra. And I kind of chalked that up to, oh, well, Kieran clearly is smitten with his own character. He doesn't want to let it go, right? But the idea that the Star Wars, you know, kind of books would, you know, kind of churn creators, and that we'd get a few years of some folks and then they'd cycle through. I got to admit, I was surprised to hear you taking over the main title. How did that come about, or what was the decision there?
I mean, the short version is they asked me and I said yes.
It's convenient how that works, right?
It's funny. It's always the awful thing. I mean, I'm always Warren Ellis' standard answer is, you know, why I'm doing a work for hire job is, oh, they offer to pay me.
Yeah.
Mine is slightly less cynical than that. What's the shame? Basically, I kind of like said like about a year ago, I wouldn't do any more work for hire apart from the stuff I've already started.
Right.
So that was me like, yeah. And this, and for me, kind of the Star Wars stuff feels like this logical extension of this ballooning aspect of, oh yeah, Aphra doesn't feed in one-to-one into Star Wars, but playing around in Star Wars and doing a Star Wars book feels like a continuation in the same way that, I don't know, going from Four to Journey to Mystery and Journey to Mystery to Young Avengers and Young Avengers to Angela felt like a single movement. You know, they weren't all necessarily connected books, but they were kind of like a similar place. I thought about it seriously, because it's that kind of... The real question with any of the Star Wars stuff is, do I have anything worth saying? And it's like, and that basically involved me looking at what Jake, you know, and it took me quite a while to think out whether I'd do it or not. The same way I didn't say yes to Darth Vader immediately. I think my initial answer was, I'll give you a, they offered me, and I said, I'll give you an answer after Screaming Citadel. In terms of like, I'll write the characters again in that kind of context and see how it works. And if I'm into it, and think I've got stuff I can do with them, I'll build from there. And, you know, I did Screaming Citadel, and there's a lot of things I liked in Screaming Citadel in terms of stuff with Luke. Luke surprised me. I wanted to do more with Leia and Han, but, like, what you can get out of Luke in this position of his journey, that felt really interesting.
Right. Well, yeah. Well, so, all the press materials said, you know, kind of highlighted that, you know, like I saw a lot of articles saying, you know, Kieran Gillen Star Wars is gonna, you know, is gonna have the original New Hope people react to Rogue One, and then this is gonna tie into Rogue One. Was that how much of that was your kind of this is what I want to do versus them coming to you saying this is the mandate from Lucasfilm?
No, it was, I mean, this sounds incredibly blasé. No, it's all me. I mean, like, normally the idea is like kind of like, when I was pitching Vader, it's always about seeing the implicit story. You know, I've said this before, so everyone who's heard me speak about Vader has probably heard this before. But the, what's the story between New Hope and Empire? And for me, it's, okay, Vader, sole survivor of military disaster, biggest disaster of all time, start of Empire, he's in a more powerful position than he's ever been.
Right.
That implies a fall and rise story. Equally, he finds out he has a son. And in other words, the last 20 years of his life have been a lie. So between those kind of two key bits, that's like, okay, that's the story I've got to tell. And it's a similar sort of thing in what I did to Star Wars here. So I was like, okay, what has Jason done? You know, Jason's primarily, you know, if I had to characterize the backbone of his arc is Luke starts exploring on his road to being a Jedi.
Agreed.
You know, and he's done a lot of that, and that's kind of been the backbone. And my read of that is, that is all. At the start of Empire, he is not a significantly better Jedi than he is at the moment in the comic. So in other words, he can't get any better. In other words, there's no more character development to do there.
Right.
You know? So in other words, I had to look at, okay, what hasn't been done? And what hasn't been done is digging into the rebellion side of it.
Right.
You know? The idea of like, okay, like all the people, including, you know, the ranks, all the people in the cast are at the start of Empire are significantly higher than they are at the end of New Hope. In other words, they all get promoted to fuck.
Right.
Secondly, I mean, you get stuff like, you know, Leia saying to Han, you're a born leader of men, that kind of thing. Han Solo is a born leader of men. We haven't seen that.
Yeah.
You know, and at the same time, you know, the interesting thing about Empire Strikes Back is the Empire is very clearly struck back before the start of Empire Strikes Back, you know? Because if you think about it logically, the Death Star is an enormous military investment, like enormous. It's very hard to think of it. And it does two things. Both prove A, what the Empire is planning to do, and B, the Empire can do it, and C, they failed. So there's a window where rebellion could genuinely take off. In fact, and also people have motivation to rebel, because if we don't do it now, we're never going to get a chance to do it, because God knows what we're going to build next. And that's the story. So in other words, it's A New Hope. It's really hopeful at the end for the rebellion. And then the Empire Strikes Back. But the Empire must have struck, because, you know, when we start Empire Strikes Back, they're on Hoth, they're in a crappy base. they're literally described as running to the edge of the galaxy. Something has gone terribly wrong before Empire kicks off. And that's the story I want to tell. The kind of the period of hope and people pulling together, and then this enormous fucking tragedy that kind of changes everything for the rebellion and sets up Empire.
Right.
So in other words, it's kind of the opposite arc of what I did with Vader, and you know, and kind of how our hero is at the heart of it. So, and of course, when you start thinking in those lines, if you think a bit more militaristic, if you think a bit more about the kind of political stuff, you're kind of thinking about Rogue One.
Yeah,
you know, because Rogue One was a war movie, you know, a war movie in Star Wars, and so the idea of rubbing up the Rogue One's aesthetic against A New Hope's character struck me as interesting. And also, you know, some of it's really basic. Like when I sat down and watched Rogue One, I thought various things, but one of the first things was, I wonder what Luke makes of this.
Yeah. Well, because that's the thing, because at the same time, like what they're doing, it's kind of really fascinating when you think about it, because, you know, we have the three original movies that we've all grown up with, that we all know by heart and all that sort of stuff. And then you've got this, you know, kind of saying, you know, Lucasfilm and Disney, you know, rolling out these new movies, rolling out these new cartoons, you know, Marvel rolling out these new comics that are adding to the lore. But that leaves you with more questions, right? Like walking out of Rogue One, it's like, it expanded on one line of the scrawl of A New Hope, but the implications were that much more greater.
Mm. I mean, one of the things, this is always my philosophy of Star Wars, that, you know, you answer questions. I forgot the name of the critic. Her name's Tegan. But I was reading Chris, basically Star Wars has to lead more. Every time you answer a question, you should make more answers. Sorry, every time you answer a question, you should create more questions. As the point of Star Wars is, it's big.
Right.
You know, it's not about being hermetically sealed. It's about the idea of everybody, you know, everybody in the cantina is interesting.
That's the same kind of rule that we're currently going through with Twin Peaks right now with David Lynch. We're like,
Yeah.
Every question that we get answered, we get three more that we don't understand, right?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's kind of for a different aspect, you know, absolutely for opposite aesthetic effects. I mean, Twin Peaks is meant to unnerve you, and Star Wars is meant to excite you about the possibility of, like, what that bet that dude in the background, he's got a cool story, I bet. Yeah. Tegan O'Neill was the name of the critic. And that's kind of, like, really quite core to my approach. And I was, you know, and it's sort of thing people know implicitly in Star Wars, but the second you know it, you actually make it know it explicitly, you can use it as a magnetic north.
Right.
I mean, like, and this, if you also actually go back to your actual question, is in terms of, you know, I'm kind of given, like, a free reign to pitch what I like, and I'm sure they'll be saying no, but I genuinely try to pitch, okay, what is the biggest and most important story to do for this character? It's right. Like, I'm not going to pitch anything that isn't that.
Right.
And,
right.
In this case, it's like, for, you know, I want to see what Luke knows when how many people died to give him the information to take that shot. I mean, you know, Luke in A New Hope is a sole hero.
Right.
You know, he's like, he's this, you know, he is a general hero. And the idea that this chain of people who died on his way to give him that shot, that's a big thing.
Right.
You know, and across the entire cast, you know, there's lots of, you know, you take Leia to Jeddah, you know, and Jeddah is, you know, one of the very few other planets that was hit by a Death Star. So that kind of weird connection between Jeddah and Alderaan, that's poetic important. You know what I mean? And so by taking to them, you get some real meaty character stuff, and you can set them on a different direction.
Yeah, well,
it sounds terribly arrogant. I know. It's like, I just pitched the best story. It's like, as if I know what the best story is. But you know what I mean? It's like, it's literally as a kind of a fan and admirer of the thing. It's okay. What do I want to know?
Right.
You know, and that's always a pretty good magnetic north.
Yeah, and being in a position to be able to tell that's great. And I guess the question is, how do you balance that as the magnetic north or the thesis of the story without getting too distracted by that, you know, that alien in the background or whatever? Like, how attractive is the allure to go really specific into the ephemera versus, you know, kind of, you know, sticking with Luke and Leia and Han in the main story?
It's true. You always want to, like, pick the problems of stories. You always want to add new stuff at the same time as, you know, sticking with Han, Luke, and Leia. And for me, that's the way. Like, I'm just about to finish my fourth issue. Like, the second we get off this phone call, I'll finish it.
Yeah.
And, like, balancing them, you know, because it's a big cast, especially for, like, Chewie and the droids in as well. You know, and if you're trying to do meaningful character beats for all of them, especially because I kind of want to make Leia co-lead.
Right.
Because that's one of my other observations in terms of, like, the thing we know about, like, The Force Awakens is that, you know, Leia never becomes a Jedi.
Right.
You know, she's more sensitive, but she doesn't go there. So for me, the point of Leia is Leia decides to take different priorities. She decides to prioritize the, the more practical world, you know, right. And the idea of, you know, without doing like anything that's too cheesy in terms of Leia, you know, Leia explicitly doesn't follow that sort of side of it. And she has it inside her, you know?
Right. Well, I always interpreted that as she was clearly, I mean, as being raised a politician, you know, like that sort of thing, you know, like, and you know, it made sense to me if Force Awakens had Leia, you know, as badass Jedi with a lightsaber, that wouldn't have felt true to the character to me.
Yeah, this is exactly what I mean, though. Yeah, as in, yes, it wouldn't feel true to your characters, but I want to really make that explicit.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
In terms of, like, you know, because, you know, Lucas spent the entire first, you know, all of Jason's running around trying to be a Jedi, whilst Leia has been trying to basically follow the mission her father left her with.
Right.
You know? And that's a kind of... And both of them could have done the other person's job. I mean, actually, okay, I don't think Luke could have, but Leia could have gone and tried to become a Jedi if she kind of, like, somebody told her it was an option for her.
Right.
So the idea of, like, push, you know, without doing... making it too obvious for this, it should be not obvious the characters don't... You know, it should be clear that the characters don't really know it. But, like... sort of getting a dramatic tension between the two. I think that could be interesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think it is interesting. I'm writing it.
Yeah. Well, I hope you think it's interesting. So what I also find interesting, you know, coming off of the Vader series and to the Dr. Aphra self-titled series, is just how Aphra as a character has taken off. I mean, the whole action, I mean, they're making an action figure out of her. You know, so you know, I know, you know, and I know over in Star Wars, Jason created Sana, and we've had new characters introduced, but I don't think we've seen a new character from the comics take off in the way that Aphra has. I'm sure you're not surprised by it because you created her, but what, you know, when you step back and look at it, like, is that like, wow, I added something to the lore?
Yeah, honestly, no, you say that, but no, I completely am taken aback by it. Because it's like, you feel like anytime you're doing a work for hire, like you're writing a work for hire universe you never created, and you add one of your own characters, there's an element of, you feel inappropriate. in the idea that, you know, it's like, why am I drawing a moustache on the Mona Lisa? You know, as in, like, do I get to put this character and put her next to Darth Vader and, you know, say, oh, yeah, take her seriously.
Right.
So the step that people responded to after pretty much immediately, oh, yeah, that was incredibly heartening. And it's like, phew, that, you know, because I was always trying to be, like, respectful to Vader. You can't just, you know, but at the same time, the dynamic between the two of them was why the book worked.
Yeah.
So no, I'm completely surprised. It's like one of the things that, you know, I've created, as you know, from my Marvel stuff, I've created a bunch of characters. And my kind of normal response to a book is add more people.
Sure.
But, you know, Aphra's the one who definitely appears to have the most legs. So yeah, it's interesting. She's an enormous, interesting mess of a human being.
That's the kind of thing. I gotta imagine you're gonna work her into the main title, or
probably not, actually.
Oh, really?
I have no plans to include Aphra in like first 18 issues.
Okay.
You know, like, you never say never, but like in terms of what I want to get up to, like, the first arc is Jedha, the second arc is something else, and the third arc is something else, and Aphra doesn't fit into the them. You know, I can't see how I would want to fit Aphra into any of them. Right. However, there's a put it the other way, there's certainly elements from Star Wars I want to bring over to Aphra.
Okay, got it.
That's it, you know what I mean? As in, there's certain things from Star Wars that are going to turn up into Aphra. And yeah. I think we're clear to issue 25, last I heard, which is, you know, that's the most, you know, a year on is about all they ever say you're definitely doing.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, we've got definitely, me and Sai, who is now co-writing Aphra, we've got this big sort of place to play with, and the toys pass back and forth.
Right. It's funny because so one thing I want to talk to you about is the art on these books, right? So so you're working with Salvador LaRocca again, who you worked with on Vader, who's been on Star Wars with Jason for a little bit, right? But during the Screaming Citadel, on Dr. Aphra, during the Screaming Citadel story arc, you worked with Andrea Brocardo, who had more of a, you know, while LaRocca has his LaRocca style, which often is, you know, very realistic. Try not to say photo reference, but you know what I mean.
I mean, yeah, he's a photo realist. He uses reference, you know.
Yeah. And I was taken aback by Brocardo because I like the cartoony style. You know, it reminded me the most of the old, you know, Walt Simonson, you know, Al Williamson kind of take on Star Wars back in the 80s and that sort of thing. Where do you stay? Like, when you close your eyes and see your Star Wars book, I know it's with LaRocca, but what art style do you think, you know, tells those stories best?
There's at least one thing. The fact, obviously, Salva has been on the Star Wars book before.
Yeah.
In fact, he's been, you know, he's had that one. He's had the look. One thing we're trying to do in the Jedha arc and the start of it, it's also, of course, being Salva, also leading into a different sort of approach to Salva. Okay. It's like you sort of saw that actually in his work on the Screaming Citadel as well. You know, yeah. He can do like quite, you know, glossy high action stuff, which is, you know, all the kind of the main look he's been doing in the Star Wars book.
Right.
But in terms of like Screaming Citadel, oh, he drew it as a horror book. You know, you look at like how he's actually framing panels and like the shadow effects he's using. He's doing horror. Okay. So like in what I'm trying to do in this, the atmosphere is a bit more Rogue One. It's a bit more gritty. You know.
Warlike, right? Yeah.
Yeah. You know what I mean? So a lot of it is like, you know, Salva is adaptable enough to sort of, whilst, you know, always being a photorealist,
right,
to play with the mood a bit. And so a lot of it is I like somebody who can adapt to the mood. You're right. Anyway, the same thing is always you write for the artist.
Right.
I mean, the trick in something like Screaming Citadel, which was a fairly extreme, you know, it was a fairly extreme take on like Star Wars. And like the first, Marcio, the first artist who did the Zero issue.
Yeah,
And the trick there was starting something which is absolutely classic Star Wars. It's like, you know, Luke walks into a bar and gets into trouble. And then across the essay, we slowly segue into a gothic horror story.
Yeah, no, we noticed that. Yeah, the blood vampires.
Yeah, we weren't subtle. You know what I mean? It's always about trying to write for the artist. Same way, you know, like Kevin on Aphra. I think that's the best, probably the best example. In terms of like Kevin just finished off the issue 13, which, you know, issue 13 that wraps off our first year on it.
Yeah.
You know, Kevin's got this kind of 2000 AD kind of style, which is like leans slightly more to the cartoony side,
right,
which suits, you know, the mood of high adventure in Aphra's book, I think.
Right. I gotta say, I don't think there was a more Kieran-inspired influence in Star Wars than the murder droids. Like when I first read that, I was just like, oh, Kieran, I had the same reaction to one of your Twitter puns. Honestly, like for me, it's a high, that those characters are a highlight. I just laugh whenever they're on there because it was such an obvious kind. I don't want to say obvious and that's simple.
Oh, no, obvious.
Like,
it's not.
Yeah, totally obvious. Like it is a darkness to 3PO and R2's lightness, right? And it just works so well. So I mean, I got to imagine that's a lot. They're a lot of fun to write for you.
Oh yeah, I mean there's always too much 000 dialogue. You know, I just cut it back. He's one of the sort of characters who's always got something to say, and it's normally murderous. It's like, you know, as I said, like when we were doing Vader, the idea was basically invert the Star Wars cast. You know, because we wanted it to feel like a Star Wars book, just a dark Star Wars book. It wasn't like an Imperial book,
right?
Because you read a Star Wars book for that high adventure and stuff. You know, high adventure, romance, and comedy. And if you just do it as an Imperial book, that's really grey fascist.
Right. Yeah.
So, like, trying to work out ways to get a dynamic similar to Star Wars whilst being in a very different sort of place. You know, Vader is Luke is basically the way my book worked.
Right.
So, let's just invert the droids and roll with it.
Oh, that's clever.
Yeah. Of course, it's like, for me, Star Wars, as I said, I use the metaphor of playing the blues. I mean, like, I'm quite a pretentious writer in terms of, like, everything's overcomplicated. And with Star Wars, I'm like, no, big archetypes, keep it really, like, pure and go for the throat. The core of Aphra being, you know, evil Indiana Jones. And then, you know, there's more to it than that. But, you know, the core is absolutely hit the big archetype. You know, Inspector Feinoff, when, you know, he's Imperial Sherlock Holmes.
Right.
And you work out a way to do the archetype and do it in Star Wars. And that's the way I try to approach the book. And, you know, and incredibly polite, murderous protocol droid. That's fun. You know, he has some of his finest moments to come in, like Aphra as well, so far.
Great.
I mean, of course, you know, you've read my previous stuff in Murderous Droids is kind of one of my motifs. You know, and I always try to give him like a very complicated ethical system, like really justify it. And, you know, in the case of UNIT, you know, absolutely accept and internalize it. And, you know, as opposed to like someone like 451, he in Iron Man, he was like falling apart due to his contradictions. He was full of guilt and loathing, but still doing these horrific acts. Conversely, I thought, okay, I've tried being clever. Let's just do one which really likes killing. let's strip away the ethics and just have a guy, I'm just into what I do, man. And it's, you know, there's a bit more, like, I don't want to say much more about where we go with 000. There's a little more to it. And it's always about the subtleties you kind of get from the writing. Like, you get the kind of him, he's very into politeness. He's got that kind of, like, Hannibal Lecter. Oh, the one thing he can't stand is rudeness.
Yes, yeah. But there's also a justification in that, like, every situation for him makes sense to end in murder.
Oh, yeah.
Right? That's and even as reading it, it makes sense. It's like, oh, yeah, when you look at it that way, like, it's just...
he's never, like, you try to act according to... I mean, this is basic, this is standard sort of writing. Everyone does stuff for a reason. Yeah. And part of the fun is, like, you get to know more about the reasons. Why does Aphra support the Empire? Yeah, that's one of the hard... She's somebody who you'd imagine wouldn't.
Yeah.
But, you know, her position is, normal weak people need, like, a really strong government to protect them. I don't need that, but they do.
Right.
And that's kind of, like, one of those weird double... I mean, Aphra's a hypocrite. That's kind of part of her... she constantly realises she's a hypocrite and then kind of dodges around it somehow. Yeah. And that's the kind of her... That's, you know, the monster at the heart of the character. That's why, you know, she's not just, you know, she goes from grey to dark grey, occasionally to black, and then maybe inching towards light grey momentarily. that's some level why she's compelling in that kind of, that she's such a mess, you know, a mess of a human being.
Yeah.
I mean, we've invented a new villain for the Jedi arc, and I had an idea, you know, had a similar big archetypal idea for a different sort of Imperial officer.
Yeah.
And like the more I've written him, the more I'm like, actually, no, I really like you. And that's you know what I mean? As in, like, when you find yourself cackling, as in, oh yeah, you're being funny and in a brutal, you know, you're an entertaining guy to watch, but you're also really brutal and kind of scary to be in the room with. And from his perspective, everything is reasonable. I mean, there's this one bit where he starts praising some of the rebels, and I didn't really realise that until I started writing it. I was like, oh no, he would completely love that guy. He just thinks he's on the wrong side.
Well, I got to imagine that that's got to be a challenge, you know, to on the creating villain side of things, because there's so many archetypes in Star Wars, and there's so and it's and I imagine it's so easy just to fall into the, you know, imperial bureaucrat type, you know, kind of role. And I think that's why, like, characters like Thrawn have resonated. You know, and now, you know, with the murder droids and Aphra and things like that, where it's like it's not the typical kind of just imperial, you know, kind of goose stepper.
Yeah, you got, you know, that's the thing, you want people to remember. I mean, we've got the Aphra's foil, Tolvin.
Yeah.
You know, we have more plans for Tolvin down the line. But it's like trying to make interesting Imperial officers, and like, why, you know, why do they join the Empire? You know, sometimes they're just like, it's the only thing to do. And other than, they have very personal reasons for doing it. And, you know, they're bad guys. So they've got to, you know, they're deluded.
Yeah.
Or they've got to be wrong in some way. But at the same time, they're doing it for a reason. And, you know, and the good ones... Yeah, you know, and eventually people either realize they're wrong and, you know, change their ways, or get consumed by the hubris. Right. You know, that's basic, like, that's writing that goes all the way back to the Greeks. What is this character's hamartia? What is the fatal flaw which will destroy them?
Right.
And that's what villains are about. You know, their villains show us what we shouldn't do.
Yeah. So and then, so last question on Star Wars, and moving kind of away from villains and more to the light side, on the rebellion side, you know, now writing the main book, you've got, you know, you've got the classic, you know, Luke, Leia, Han, Chewie, all that sort of stuff. Jason and I have been at odds for several years over this, and I'm gonna ask you where you stand. What role does Wedge Antilles play in your run on Star Wars?
Wait and find out is the best way of putting it, I think. As in, like, the fact we are more on the military side would mean that logically you might see Wedge would turn up more. But okay, we'll see how it goes.
So now, do you subscribe to the belief that Wedge is the hero of the rebellion?
I think you should have to wait until the book to see my turn. Are you aware of Veers? No Veers.
No.
Sorry, Veers Watch. He's a guy on Twitter. Veers Watch is a Star Wars Twitter guy.
Oh, Veers Watch.
Yes. Look him up. He's amazing. All he does is, he basically, every piece of canon Star Wars, he does a one tweet review, which is name of the book : Veers or no Veers, depending on whether or not Veers is in it or not.
That's great.
And I just thought, if I ever find a chance, I just want to say, whatever bit where, like, the Emperor says, who should we deploy? Should we deploy General Veers? No Veers. but I would never do that, sadly. Or will I?
I know. Well, I mean, it was with bittersweet irony that Jason finally put Wedge in Star Wars and had him say, "I got this." Which drove us up a wall. Oh man, the I don't know. I don't know if you've caught wind of that, but over on iFanboy, we've been railing against the trope of "I got this" or "we got this" as a writing tool, because it seems every other book has someone saying "I got this."
I've got. Yeah. It's like tropey language is tricky. It's one of those bits you go like, yeah, it's quite hard to unpack. I think, as in, like, occasionally, just because what else do people fucking say? And they might, like, hello, I would open, you know, there's some bits of dialogue which is just kind of stuff that people genuinely do say.
Right.
And it's efficient ways of phrasing it, so they kind of fall back to it. But sometimes it's just, here is dialogue people says in an action sequence.
Right, yeah. I totally get it, as it's a bridge, it's an extension, it's a way to tell someone to get out of the way, I'm going to do this or whatnot. But when you, like us, every Wednesday when you're reading 20 to 30 books and you're seeing it over and over again, it just gets so exhausting. So,
of course, the Wait What podcast guys, you know, take one of them and turn it into the title of the podcast.
Right, yeah, exactly. So. Yeah. All right, well, moving on from Star Wars. So it's been about 3 years of Wicked and Divine in existence. You know, I had the pleasure of working with you and Jamie to help launch the book when I was over at Image. And I think it's great that it's still going. I wanted to ask you, the world of comics as a creator is much different now than it even was 3 years ago, right? And being in the create, you know, having a foot in the work for hire and a foot in the creator-owned world, what's your take on the position of a creator and the ability to keep a book like Wicked and Divine in print and going?
How to phrase this? Yeah. The thing about Wicked and Divine is, we're in a blessed situation that makes our position, like, not exactly useful. I mean, it's just this kind of, like, how to succeed in creating your own book, do a book that sells a lot and sells lots in trades. And, you know,
right.
Yeah, we're in the position where our initial trade, you know, the our sales in the initial trade, you know, I think it basically our sales in the first month of trade is something like 20K, you know, So we're selling in trades what it would keep to, you know, take to keep a Marvel book alive in the first month.
Right.
You know? That's not a situation people have. So for Wiccan Divine, it's just a completely different kind of, you know, problem. The idea, you know, the idea I'm sort of wrestling with in terms of like my new image books and thinking about doing, like, okay, you know, how do you make it operate in a different sort of climate, which isn't Wiccan?
Right. Yeah. 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 Because it's almost, and then it also begs the question that if you guys were starting Wiccan now, would you still have the same success, or was it the byproduct of the market 3 years ago, and then it builds that foundation for you to grow upon? You know.
Yeah. There's definitely all that. You know, which I find really, really. I mean, we leveraged our, you know, the hype coming off the back of Young Avengers, right, to do our own thing. You know, that's the kind of, we use, you know, that's basically the slingshot that launched Wiccan. You know, plus the fact, you know, I wanted to do a book that was pop. You know, let's show that, you know, a book with a degree of swagger. That's the kind of degree of Wiccan. And people, it's quite funny because, like, it's all, the thing with Wiccan is, by us acting like it was a big deal, it became a big deal.
Right.
You know, like, we hyped it really hard, and we did, you know, there's level of that kind of arrogant grandeur to the whole kind of vibe, but at the same time whilst also being me, and, you know, I tend to fall downstairs, so it's just like being us and deliberately being us as loud as we could. So I must admit, from the outside we look cleverer than we are. But I mean, with Wiccan, we take a quite different route to many of the people who have booked them quite big. Yeah. In that we, you know, Wiccan comes out for it basically every month.
Yeah.
You know, something, you know, there was we don't do gaps. There was like a 2 to 3 month gap between issue 17 and 18.
Right.
Where we kind of realigned the book. But from then on, something Wiccan has come out every single month. Like, it's either the issues, and we use the gaps to prove, you know, we run specials in the gaps, then a month of the trade, and then back in again. And in this case, we're doing a Christmas issue, and then trade in January, and then a 1920 special, then Jamie back for year four.
Right.
You know, so in other words, that's what the way Wiccan works. And at least that is partially, whilst we're very aware that people can make the saga model work, we're a little too insecure. Like, right, we like the idea, you know, we've definitely seen some creators who've had like a 3 month drop, you know, 3 months, and then their sales have dropped when they've come back, you know?
Right.
Like, and we quite like the idea of, oh no, we're willing to prepare to be professional and release something every single month.
Well, yeah, so professional's
a loaded term, but you know what I mean?
Sure. Well, the way I see it is you're minimizing risk. I mean, anytime you're out of the marketplace, that's an opportunity for someone to forget and then, you know, start buying another book instead, right? So you're probably, you know, being smart in that regard, and that probably has a lot to do with why it's been able to maintain its popularity, because, you know, it's better to give people more, right, than less.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, there's a kind of, people, what I find most interesting when people talk about Wiccan, they always talk about the way they consume the book being the only way they could consume the book. As in, why would anyone buy in single issues, you know? or trade buyers, or vice versa. And it's like, kind of, well, Wiccan is sort of designed in that kind of Russian doll model. And that, you know, we really do try to work it. So if you're following it every month, there's a meaningful reason to buy it. And if you're engaged in fandom and talking to people about it, you know, it's the Game of Thrones, watching Game of Thrones live. But, you know, we're also aware that people like binge watching. So, like, the trades are designed to be singular aesthetic entries.
Right.
Entities. So, and then basically the trades act like big singles, with, like, the end of each trade normally being a cliffhanger big enough to carry you the 6 to 7 months to the next trade to arrive.
Right.
You know? And we also think about the level of the series, because, so when it's all over, you know, it'll be like just shy of 50 issues, I think, including the specials. Or maybe actually it will be 50 issues. I'll have to do the math on that again, because since we've added a special, my math has changed. and we'll also think on the higher level. I mean, that's kind of the big frustration about Wiccan, in terms of, like, you know, I had it pretty well planned towards all at the start. Especially now, I just want to, like, sit down and tell everybody how it ends.
Well, that was actually my question, is here we are 3 years from now, and I know that you meticulously plan or stuff like that. Are we where you intended to be 3 years later, or what?
Yeah.
How many detours have we taken?
Oh, yeah, lots. I mean, there's one thing that, like, the way I always put it, there's a big structural, like, backbone in terms of the cliffhanger at the end of every trade, I know. You know, as in, this is the big emotional structure of the whole thing. And that means I know waypoints. Right. And then I also know all the characters. As in, this character is this, their Hamasha, their Fatal Flaw is this. This is their journey, and they will end up here, and this is how they will die. And there was always the question of how you will approach the media, how you will use that material and work it into the book. So you know all the subplots, when do you enter them? When do you, you know, it's like symphonic writing, I'm going to use the phrase. As in, you have all these refrains. I know, listen to me.
I know. It's okay, though. I mean, it's your process. I wouldn't expect any other.
Yeah, you know, it's like, okay, I need to start putting these notes in. People kind of, when they do a reread of Wicked, because it's always meant to be reread, it's, oh, yeah, that was foreshadowed on this panel. Right. You know, people have been foreshadowing, like, realizing. I mean, say, like, the stuff presently going on with Dionysius and him being into Cassandra.
Yep.
You know, and that's for, you know, that involves something in issue three that I, you know, something in issue two I say is a throwaway, what seems to be a throwaway one-off joke that is reused, which is referenced in a backup story in issue 16, and that's then brought up in issue 27. You know what I mean?
Right.
So that's what I mean by the refrains. I wasn't sure when that stuff was going to come in, but I knew that stuff was going to come in.
Right.
And like a lot of it's like stuff like Baphomet and Morrigan's plot. I mean, I always knew where I was taking that. And but it's like, this sort of where I was going to end that plot. It was like, I wasn't sure. I thought it was maybe it'll end around 25, or maybe it ends up around issue 35 instead.
Right.
And then she just, you know, obviously, yeah, this plot hasn't ended by issue 25. So I decided to go later. But there was always that kind of like, there's this crucial, you know, there's certain plot beats which are bigger. You know what I mean? As in, like, and it's always a question of like arranging the material. You know, stuff has stuff changed? Yes, stuff has changed, but it's all in how you choose to execute it.
Right. So it's almost like you had a toolbox going into it, stuff you know you want to do, and then part of, I guess I would imagine part of the adventure is seeing how it lays out in front of you too. Like, I mean, you've probably been surprised by the directions you've taken the story yourself in, right?
Oh yeah. I mean, like I've had I knew the final issue and how it ended up. Yeah. And you know, there's, but. I mean, even like a couple of days ago, I had an insight. I said, oh no, that's what happens in the final issue, and that's how it all works.
Right.
And it's like a lot of it's just like you live with this stuff for a long time, and you think about what you may know. Like, the most simplest, okay, the art might be this character betrays this other character. But, you know, some might not know how they betray this character.
Right.
You know, and some of the specific, you know, and some of the stuff just gets better and more interesting and rich because you've spent like 4 years thinking about it.
Right.
I've been thinking about like what these characters mean to each other and ways they could integrate and what the book's really about. Because, you know, at the same, you know, as much as I'm a planner, I don't like, it's not like there's a graph or anything. As in, I'm basically, you know, if I knew what this book really meant on every single level, I would have like, why wouldn't it have written the book?
Right. Yeah.
if it's something that's not complicated enough, if it's something that's, you know, simple enough to understand that basically, I would have tweeted it.
Yeah.
You know, as in, no, if I spend 5 years on something, it's because this is an emotional journey. I mean, early on in Wicked, I said like Wicked was deliberately a ritual to me to get over my own sorry ass.
Yeah.
You know, as in it's about me trying to basically, you know, beat myself up and make myself grow up and kind of metaphorically kill all these identities I would have killed to be. You know, and that's there. And the weird thing about Wicked, I see it working. There's stuff which I've suffered extreme anxiety about. It, like, I can't, when Wicked is over, I can't wait to, you know, talk about, oh yeah, I was completely losing sleep during this period because of this. But I've had to get over my, you know, as if I've realised, no, I have to be easy. It doesn't matter. and it makes you focus what really does matter.
Right. Well, we were talking actually offline. We were talking about how I'm impressed how you're always excited for the new issue that comes out, and you're on Twitter or you're talking about it, and I think that stems from your and Jamie's approach to the book, where it just, from at least for me reading it, still, you know, 3 years later, each issue of Wicked and the Vine has a vitality to it. You know, that like a life to it in and of itself, that it's like you want to dive in and see what the next thing is. And I think part of that is your guys' willingness to experiment with the form and with the, you know, the format of storytelling. And how much of that has been pre-planned versus kind of emerging just in the natural collaboration?
A bit of both. I mean, there's normally like the big centerpieces that you have. Like, it's like the rave issue, that'd be a good example. That you know, or the remix issue. These are kind of my list of things I would like to do. But there's definitely but there's other ones which came along the way, like the magazine issue. That came of how can we possibly do a Kevin Wadder issue?
Right. Yeah.
And that, you know, that all improvised from that fundamental. Kevin wants to do an issue. He doesn't do sequentials.
Yeah.
But there's also a list of darlings I've never got to do yet. I mean, there's one which I'm increasingly sure I won't be able to do now.
Yeah.
I look at how many issues are left, because I've written up to issue 33, okay. And there's probably 12 issues left of the main series plus a couple of specials. And I'm pretty sure I haven't got the space to do that. And it's literally something I've tried to do all the way from like issue 7.
Oh, really?
And something just like, no, it's good, but it's not important. I mean, okay. One of the things I always want to do is more about the world. You know, like how do people respond to the fact there's, you know, gods on the television, and more about the fat sort of fan level stuff. You know, and there'll be definitely more of that in the final year, but I don't think I'm ever going to do the big kind of thing I was planning on doing.
That's kind of the balance, because you know, where else are you going to do these kind of things that you want to do other than your own book?
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly. You know, important. I mean, like, what we're planning to do for the 1920s issue, that's another big formless weirdo thing. Yeah. As I had the idea for that, and it's like, oh, okay, well, I eventually said, fuck it, I'll do it.
Right.
And we'll see how it turns out. I mean, on the other side of it is, like, if you say so much is just like solving a problem on the page.
Right.
Like, phased issue 27, I think that was, in Imperial Phase 1, where we do the eight panel grids, and the whole story is told in weird like structures, and it becomes like absolutely fragmented. Right. That's absolutely me responding to, oh my god, I've got too many story threads.
Right.
And okay, let's make the confusion the point. you know what I mean? And then weirdly, it compressed down into a space smaller than I thought I needed, which was useful. So in other words, that kind of like, okay, this is the material. How can we get through it?
Right.
And like, you know, you do stuff like the 9-panel grid where we're starting to be Watchmen, you know, as I get my Tom King on. And then we do the 9-panel grid, and we build to that bit where we break the structure of the 9-panel grid where Persephone stabs everyone in the back.
Right.
You know, and that's like, you know, that's kind of a structuralism turning to a deep, you know, and that stuff is on the page.
Right.
You know, it's like, and that's the joy of doing something. I mean, this, I think me and Jamie are both people who've studied, people who've done what we've done before.
Yeah.
In other words, we loved all the, like, this is us doing our, like, dream Vertigo book. And partially it's like the concept of a Vertigo book must be big enough to include the creators growing, changing, and learning new shit.
Right.
So we always built, you know, the idea of this story, yeah, it's about like teenagers for 2 years in the 2010s, but it's also about all of human history and art. So, you know, but also, I mean, even stuff like, I mean, we said it was 30 to 60 issues. I think in my heart of hearts, I was always knew it was about between 40 and 50.
Okay.
And it's like, at least part of that is A, I don't want to kill Jamie by making him do it for 7 years. And B, the idea, how to phrase this, I don't think there's many Vertigo series that wouldn't be better if they were 20 issues shorter.
Interesting.
You know what I mean? As in, like, there's normally like a dead patch in the 70 issue series, and you think, I would have crunched it.
I don't quite disagree with you there. I think I'm with you on that one.
But, you know, and this is okay. And it's all, you know, we'll do it and we'll see if we're right or not.
Yeah.
But it's like every year of Wickdiff has a really its own character. And that's kind of what I'm excited about. It's like, you know, we get to the end of year three, and then it's one of the things that I'm worried about getting it all in.
Right.
But it's like, I know I have the pieces, and I know that it delineates in a way which I am not unhappy with so far, as long as I don't fuck it up.
So far. That's great.
Sorry, the last three issues, the issues about to come out, like the end of Imperial Phase, it's like so much has been setting up dominoes, and the last three issues are kind of like...
Yeah.
Like, remember issue 11? That was one of our best ones, I think, in terms of like, we set everything up, and then it was this issue of like, scene by scene by scene, it's all incredibly high-pitched. We kind of do that for three issues. Yeah. The idea that, you know, it really does motor.
Right.
So I can't wait for people to read it. In fact, I've got it in front of me, and it's like, ah!
That's great. Awesome. So
I'm a child.
Yeah, you are. But that's why we love you, Kieran. So you've been hinting at some new things coming down the line. Is there anything you can tell us about that? Or?
Yeah, I mean, like, Ludocrats, which was announced 2 years ago, has finally got through its bureaucratic nightmare. Which is a story I'll tell another time, because it's quite, I mean, it's kind of like a Brazil plot line, in that this story about it's basically a never-ending story, but for adults, in terms of, when I say adults, I mean like children with an adult sense of humour, or vice versa. I sort of describe the Ludocrats as kind of like the Meta Barons, but, you know, mix asterisks and obliques, you know, it's that kind of vibe.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's the, and David's apparently started work on that. As in, he's just finishing off a short story he did. So I need to check in with him later today. And, you know, that'll come out when it's done. It's that kind of, it's the sort of thing that, you know, I imagine it'll come out next year. As in, you know, I imagine the whole thing will be drawn before we solicit it. And, you know, that's just like me and my friend Jim Rosignol, which is an idea we had years ago, and it's us having fun. We've had to completely rewrite it a little because, how to phrase, there's elements which are, which elements of the story when we originally wrote it rub up uncomfortably with the real world at the moment. Trump has made a lot of things a lot less funny. So we've had to alter the path of a few of the items, but I quite like where it's ended up.
All right, cool, excellent. Well, I love La Fuente, so I can't wait to see it.
Oh, he's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously he's done so much great work, but it's the idea of him having a 5-issue Create Your Own series, and his art is such a big part of it. In that, you know, a lot of it's just here is a creating a landscape where David can really can show what they can do. Like, this is him tearing up the pages of like imaginative weird shit and funny and human and entertaining for like 5 issues. And I think people are going to gawp at it.
Cool. And then there's what do you call the other
spangly
new thing?
It's like Boyan Ellis gives all his stuff in the newsletters like serious code names.
Yeah.
So I just thought I'm going to call mine spangly new thing because that says everything about me. Yeah, spangly new thing, which is an ongoing, probably almost like, for Image. I can't see why it wouldn't be, as in Erica said yes to it. with an artist, we haven't said the artist yet, but that's someone I've worked with before. I think they're amazing. Like, it's a short ongoing, I think. It's not as long as Wick Div. Like, probably about that, remember that Losers kind of length, maybe?
Yeah, yep.
Yeah, yeah. And it is, I've said it's genre, which is a fantasy book. It's fantasy, but it's kind of another midlife crisis book. It involves... It's a little bit like... I mean, I reread Planetary to sort of do some thinking about how it could possibly work. So it's kind of a deconstructionary fantasy book, which is unpicking a lot of the ideas of what fantasy is for.
Okay.
Is the best way of putting it. I'm deliberately trying to write it for... It's lead characters are older than I am. I mean, it's such a weird thing that I feel that people tend to think I write teenagers a lot, and that's because I do. but like, you know, there's a huge chunks of my book which work isn't.
Yep.
So it's quite important, and what I'm really writing about isn't actually about youth, it's about aging and death.
Right.
You know? I write about youth because that's the stuff that goes. But I kind of explicitly part of this spangly new thing was about, I want to like, I literally think the cast of my next books have to be older than me. And also it's less pop. I mean, there's a lot of pop to it because I can't avoid that. But it's less pop.
Yeah, are you able to not do that?
Yeah. But it's like, I've written a draft of the first issue.
Yep.
Just to show the artist, this is, you know, because they're doing the character, because there's a lot of design. It's another book which I really want the artist to like go to town on.
Right.
So I thought, you know, I wrote an example of how the first issue was going to go to show how the characters move. You know, this is how the characters act. So you know better to know what they should look like. And there's a big fight scene in the last, you know, there's a fight scene in the last 6 or 7 pages. And that's because it's the, you know, it shows what all the characters can do.
Right.
You know, and like, that's my Marvel training coming in, because that's what you should do in a superhero book. And I sort of looking at it, and my editor, Chrissy, was like, we don't need that. That could be in the second issue. You know, what we really need is 6 pages of these characters basically screaming at each other.
Yeah.
You know, this is about the, you know, this hardcore emotional journey these people are going through. And, you know, and from the off going, oh no, this book's, I hate to use the word grown up because grown up is like elf, but it's definitely that kind of, it's not as desperate to please.
Right.
I mean, it's like pop, it comes from me looking at Sex Criminals and go and like absolutely, I feel humbled when I look at Sex Criminals, what Matt and Chip are doing, which is such a, you know, as in there's a kind of a level of openness and maturity and like pain, there's a real sort of pain. Yeah. Beneath how funny it is, and I'm like, no, I think I need to do something that is a little bit more open about this stuff. So that's what, you know, spangly new thing.
Cool, excellent. Well, I mean, you know, I've enjoyed your work for years. We'll continue to, and you know, it's great to see. I can't wait for Star Wars and see where Wicked and Divine goes and all this new stuff. It's great. So thanks for giving us some time to kind of chat. It's been good to catch up.
No, it's good. You know, it's good to speak to iFanboy. It's been years. And of course, you know, you guys were some of our biggest supporters early on. So
Still are. Yep, for sure.
Love for everyone at iFanboy.
And a big thanks to Kieran Gillen for giving us some of his time to chat. Be sure to check out Star Wars when he takes it over in October. And, of course, keep reading The Wicked and the Divine, as well as all the other great books that Kieran writes. If you want to listen to more great comics talk, go to ifanboy.com, where you can find all of our previous episodes. Every week we're talking about the latest in comics, and then we also talk about movies and TV shows as they come out, as well as there's some other Talksplode interviews in there as well. Just go to ifanboy.com. You can find everything there in the feed. So until next time, I'm Ron, and enjoy your comics. How much I was in